Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire. Creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, folks. Welcome back to the second episode of the trial of Alphonse Capone, taken from a May 10th, 1935 Chicago Tribune. It was written as a firsthand account by a former juror of the Capone in the Capone trial. His name is Arthur Prochno, P-R-O-C-H-N-O. I'm here with my good friend Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, it's good to be back here for this second episode of the trial of Alphonse Capone.
He had taken some notes while he was actually in the trial.
Right. If you remember, you asked me about that, and I said, we'll get to that because there's a little bit of a story.
I mean, it's not normal that you're allowed to. I mean, this is in 1930, so they didn't have tape recorders or phones that they could.
Right. Jurors can take notes.
They just can't keep them.
They can't keep them. They can't share them with anybody, but they can take notes during. Because you think about it, you're getting inundated with tons of data during the day, information. You know, like this person says they did that, and then you've got a DNA expert, and then you've got an eyewitness, then you've got this, and you've got that. I mean, it's a whole day of nothing but information going in. If you don't write it down, you know, I mean, it's kind of hard to it just all run together after a while. Mainly, I've sat, watched juries operate when I was a clerk. I was a intern clerk for a judge in Jackson County between my second, third year of law school, and I saw several jury trials. I just sat all the way through them acted as a clerk and took some notes for the judge and, you know, like went out and did research for him if a point of law came up or something like that. If he had a question, you know, that he didn't want to ask either one of the lawyers, some procedural point or something like that he wasn't sure about, and I would go do that. And so I sat initially like a juror. And you know, what happens really is you get an initial impression of a lot from body language, from the body language and the way people testify, by seeing them, and what they say is not quite so important as how they say it and how they hold their mouth, how they hold their head, how they look you in the eye or not, and you get this impression pretty quickly, and then from then on you kind of already got your mind made up. I've never really sat on a jury where I had to vote. I've sat through voir dire a couple of times, and they didn't take me. The first time I was a policeman, the second time they didn't even get as far. I was a lawyer, and they would have kicked me off immediately, except I wasn't selected. There were so few trials that day. I was one of the people that got to go home about 10:30 that morning. But in regards to his taking notes, here's what he wrote about that. It wasn't long before I clashed with the jury guards. I took notes of the testimony the first morning. During the recess, the guard ordered me to stop taking notes. He said it was not allowed. I told him to ask the judge. He said he could not do this. I pointed out that jurors ought to be permitted to take notes, the same as lawyers and others who were more familiar with the trial of cases. I don't know if the guard asked the judge, but anyway, I was permitted to take notes. They proved helpful later on. That explains how he's got all these details from that case. This is a pretty important document. This is like what we call a primary source document. The only thing better would be the trial transcript, but this is pretty good. This is
actually one of the jurors that sat there.
Right, and his impressions of what was going on. It's a lot more important document than actually just reading the transcripts, because here you got somebody's impression that saw these witnesses testify. And for example, as the trial progressed, I, for one, got the idea that the government lawyers are making a good case out of nothing and that they did not want Capone's tax money near as much as they wanted him and the honor that went with a conviction. I'd learned he had offered the tax money in compromise earlier. We were all impressed with the bearing and evident fairness of Judge Wilkerson and the conduct of the prosecution and defense lawyers. District Attorney George E.Q. Johnson, Dwight N. Green, Samuel Clausen, and Jacob I. Grossman were for the prosecution, Michael Ahern and Albert Fink for the defense. We naturally studied Capone considerably and noted that he had a ready smile. We were highly concerned with every bit of evidence, every exhibit, every witness. We were particularly interested in the grandiose things we had read about Capone, some of which now were being unfolded to us. We heard about his Florida mansion and walled-in estate on Palm Island. We tried to visualize it. Some of us recall seeing pictures of Capone clad in a bathing suit and fishing from the deck of his yacht. Witnesses told of huge sums that Capone spent on entertainment. In addition, there was evidence on gambling. Stacks of checks for thousands of dollars were introduced. These were described as representing gambling gains and losses. This impressed us. So did the diamond belt buckles that Capone gave to his friends. The trial was long. We were naturally tired at times. This probably was due more to our confinement than to anything else. We were practically prisoners in our hotel, our meals excellent but too heavy, considering the little exercise we were allowed. One of the jurors, Mr. Mather, became ill. For a time, we thought the case would be delayed. Walking was our main exercise. Occasionally, we were on short strolls on Michigan Avenue, but mostly on walks around the federal building during the noon recess. This was not always pleasant. Many people, apart from newspaper men, tried to take our pictures. We did not want our pictures taken. Whenever one of us spotted a camera, we'd give a warning and dodge or turn our heads. We had our reasons. Most of us feared that pictures might make us or our families targets for annoyance. This actually happened in my case, I learned later. While I was on the jury, many automobiles drove slowly past my house, their occupants gazing intently onto the front porch. Several times, practical jokers called my wife only to hang up abruptly. This worried her. You know, we were talking about they printed and put out their names and addresses, and
they went on the radio and they said, "Here's who this guy is. His first and last name. Here's his occupation, his age, his religion, and the city he lives in."
Things were a lot different back then.
And they're worried about somebody taking their picture.
Well, that would be, you know, they already got their name and address. Now you got their picture.
Now, this was the 1930s. It would be pretty obvious when someone's trying to take their picture because you have to lug this big, huge camera.
Yeah, a big brownie box camera.
Yeah, that's like, you know, the size of a shoebox to try to take a photo.
Wasn't like getting your iPhone out and snapping a few quick shots, was it?
Get that powder to do the flash, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, stand there and stay still while I pull this piece of fabric off the hole that allows the light to come in and hits the glass to make the image and stay. Do not move for about 3 minutes, and then I'll put that back over, and then we'll develop the film later on. I don't think so.
I would worry more if the people taking the pictures didn't have, like, press credentials.
Really?
Than the people that did have press credentials. Okay. Well, these guys, they were sequestered. I'm not sure quite how long this all continued on, but they were locked up in the evening, you know, in a hotel. They were fed meals. They received cut up parts of a paper that had been edited down. They couldn't listen to the radio. Four men to a room.
It would be, and it went on for about 2 weeks. He indicates this. Here's an interesting thing he says. And there he was, a big fat man, facing the bar of justice like any other man accused of a crime, and we, 12 ordinary citizens, sitting in judgment. Near the end of the second week, we realized that this case was coming to an end. We were quite happy because all of us were anxious to get home, and some of us were on edge. Our nerves were getting a little ragged. One of the men had been ill. A few of us thought the case would be over by Friday, October 16th. That was the day that dissension first broke out. By that time, it was evident that the jury was separated into factions on question of guilt or innocence. Sounds like things are going downhill now, man. They are getting on each other's nerves, and everybody has formed an opinion, and then the groups of the guilty people are getting together, and they become enemies of the people who believe that he's innocent or not particularly innocent. Remember, this is in our jury system, we have to prove guilt in a criminal case beyond a reasonable doubt.
In a civil case,
no, you need a majority of the jurors to vote for one way or the other.
One juror can't necessarily hang a jury.
One juror cannot necessarily hang a juror. They have different rules in different jurisdictions. I think in Missouri, go on that, but it could be like just a simple majority, or it could be 10 out of 12. But in a criminal case, it has to be unanimous, and they have to believe it's beyond a reasonable doubt. They cannot have any shadow of a doubt in their mind that the person may be not guilty. And so that's why many times they'll come up with a possible other suspect. That's where prosecutors get in trouble.
Well, when a jury deliberates in something like this, and I mean, this was going on for weeks, so they would talk about it over the course, wouldn't they? Or they couldn't talk about it when they weren't at the trial.
They're not supposed to, but they always do.
I mean, if there's four guys in a room,
they're going to talk about it.
They're probably going to talk about it.
And they're going to get together with their buddies. When they find somebody else believes he's guilty, then they're going to buddy up, and they're going to talk about why he's guilty. Same with
if they have questions? Or they have to sit back and be passive?
They can ask questions. No, they can't ask questions.
They can't ask the defense prosecutor.
No, they cannot ask questions. They can, when they go into deliberations, they can have the transcript of testimony, certain testimony brought into them, and have that read to them or read it themselves. They can look at items of physical evidence. They can have those, like if there was a gun or a knife, they can have that brought back into the jury room.
Mm-hmm.
Picture of Al Capone in his mansion down in Florida or something fishing off his yacht in his bathing suit. But during the trial, they can't ask questions. They just have to sit back and in this case, take notes and then they go back, and they aren't supposed to talk about it among themselves until they get ready to deliberate. Then they can talk about it.
And now they're not quite at deliberation by Friday, October 16th?
Not quite. They're getting awfully close. Here's some of the things that he reports. Okay. Anyhow, during the noon recess on Friday, we returned to our room. I was the last man in. I found one of the first men inside waiting for me. He remarked, "We'll get this case about 4 o'clock and be home by supper." "Not with all this evidence," I answered. "To hell with evidence," he said. "The first son of a gun ties us up for over an hour, I'll smash it in his face." I didn't like this. I told him that so far I had no particular interest in the case either way, but that from now on I would do my part for fair play. "If any juror wishes to examine the evidence, I'll protect him," I added. "And if it does, I'll knock him out cold," continued the belligerent juror. Then, in a more friendly and diplomatic vein, he said, "Why, there's nothing to it. We know he's guilty. Let's give him the limit, 72 years. The judge will get credit and be appointed to the appellate court." I shook my head. I said that so far as I was concerned, there'd be no bouquets to either side. I argued that we should abide by the evidence. I told the juror I did not think Judge Wilkerson would improve his attitude. The juror I have just quoted wanted to give Capone the limit in years. Throughout the trial, all of us believed that if we convicted Capone on all 23 counts in this case, he would face a maximum of 72 years in prison. I have only recently learned the maximum would have been 32 years. Concerning the reference to Judge Wilkerson's appointment to the higher bench, I believe the judge at the time was being considered for the Circuit Court of Appeals. Back in our hotel quarters that Friday night, we showed signs of strain and uneasiness. Extra guards were posted outside. Deputies watched our every move. I felt like a goldfish. Most of us tried to pass the time reading. I was sitting on my cot reading when one of the younger jurors, most of us were over 50, sat down beside me. had a sense he had something to say, so I pretended to read. He did too. He whispered to me, "There seems to be some effort around to disregard the evidence and to give Capone the limit. I don't favor the idea. A quick verdict would look bad for us. The public might think we framed and railroaded him." "That's what I think," I replied. "I told this juror about my spat with another juror. I said I was already being suspected of wanting to tie up the jury. I told this juror I could not act on account of that suspicion. I suggested that he sound out the neutral jurors and persuade them to vote not guilty on the first ballot. After that, to do as they pleased. I did that. My idea was to prevent a stampede." This is what goes on inside of a jury room right here. This is the little push and pull and people ganging up and trying to
using intimidation to try to sway a juror.
Right. One juror is trying to intimidate the others. The other two are plotting to, you know, try to make people look at it in a more thoughtful manner rather than, and also another interesting thing is they're concerned about what the public might think about what they're doing.
If they come to a
too quick a verdict.
Deliberate too soon.
Right. So they don't want to, I know that happens. Sometimes they'll keep deliberating so they can get lunch. I remember one time we had a jury in Judge Atwell's court, and they deliberated, and they wanted lunch because we'd always bring in Gates Barbecue for lunch. They didn't get deliberated done. They didn't get their deliberations done in the morning, and then they got their Gates Barbecue. And then they, right after lunch, they went back in for about 30 or 40 minutes, came back out with a verdict. So they got, and good thing about it is they had a lot of Gates Barbecue left over, so we all got to take some too.
Helps to deliberate over some Gates Barbecue.
Yeah.
Well, so then they finally come to the closing arguments.
Yeah, he says about, I think, actually, by this time, I think they have the closing arguments. No, it doesn't. I see it's delivered on, this is Friday evening. "We had been thrilled by the closing arguments of the various lawyers. The final plea delivered Saturday morning by District Attorney Johnson was the biggest thrill of all. It meant that the trial was almost over. We knew that we'd get the case that day. This was Saturday. After Mr. Johnson had finished, Judge Wilkerson gave us his charge. He pointed out our duties and quoted the law and the general rules. He said the defendant did not have to testify at his own behalf. He said his failure to do so should not influence us. I had hoped Capone would take the stand. I presume some of the other jurors had hoped likewise. Then came the dramatic moment when the fate of Capone, the most public gangster in the world, was placed in our hands. Only a person who has served on a jury in a trial where a human being's life or liberty is at stake can comprehend the heavy responsibility."
Well, you know what? I've never served on a jury, but, you know, if you're just in a general jury, like, you know, the guys that got the other case,
right,
down the hall, probably not waiting on him quite as heavy.
No.
As Al Capone.
Although, if you think about it, just I remember watching those jurors and watching the trials, and there'd be somebody's freedom at stake, mm-hmm, many times. Maybe it's only a couple of years or 5 years or whatever, but it is something that you want to, you know, I think people take really seriously taking away somebody's freedom for a period of time. And these guys, they had not only taken away Al Capone's freedom, they had the fact he was Al Capone, the fact that he was a kingpin of hundreds, thousands of other mobsters in Chicago, that they were, you know, this was after the St. Valentine's Day Massacre.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, think about
after
it.
After their names were announced on the radio.
Their names were announced on the radio. These are the guys that went in to mowed these seven other gangsters down with machine guns. There'd been numerous amounts of shootings with machine guns, you know, catching people on the street and just trying to kill them. There was a lot of gang war going on. If you remember in our,
we talked about Murder Inc., where the guys were, you know, 400 to 1,000 people disappeared.
And we talked about Capone in the early days, and as he mentioned all these killings, Dion O'Banion and I can't remember the other one, then the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. There was a lot of gang warfare going on up until this time between Capone and Dion O'Banion and Bugsy Moran's gang. So
you might want to take a few weeks to deliberate.
Really? And you know, Chicago, even back then, I mean, Chicago's a huge city now, but back then it wasn't near as big. It was big, but in many ways it was like a small town, and everybody knew everybody to a greater or lesser extent, a little bit like Kansas City today. You know, Bill Owsley always says the reason we never had any mob guys come in and be really strong witnesses against other mob guys in Kansas City is because Kansas City's too small. So many people, you have a bunch of extended family out there, and then they will be connected up with other members of extended family and supporters of the mob guys. So that was it's pretty tough. And Chicago would have been probably in 1930s would have been about like Kansas City is today. It in many ways, it'd be like a small town.
Well, this wasn't Pochino's first jury.
I mentioned earlier that I had served on many state juries. So I wonder why he gets selected juries all the time. And I've been called twice. You've never even been called once. Don't you have a driver's license?
I don't have a driver's license.
Well,
I had one.
You had one, though. But I tell you what it is. Maybe it's that
I'm not registered to vote.
You've never registered to vote, and you've never owned real estate in Kansas City, have you?
Yeah.
So you're kind of off the grid.
It's hard to find a jury of my peers.
Aaron's kind of off the grid. He's like the Unabomber, you know. All you need to do is grow out real long hair and a beard and act all goofy, and we'd say you were the Unabomber, Aaron.
What, because I don't have a driver's license?
You're off the grid.
I didn't register to vote.
You're off the grid. You live in an apartment. You may even not have any utilities in your name.
I don't have utilities in my name.
You have a cell phone in your name, you have the name of the Big Dumb Fun Show.
Both.
Both. Yeah, that's what I figured.
I do have a month-to-month lease agreement.
Oh, well, that's not really reportable anywhere. You'd have to find out where you live first. Anyhow, moving right along here. The first time was the trial of a newsboy charged with murder. The evidence was circumstantial. It was a hanging case. You know, they used to hang people back in these days. 10 jurors wanted to hang him. Another juror and I held out for life. Something, we don't know what, it wasn't sentiment, urged us not to vote death. We didn't. The newsboy got life and went to prison. 7 years later, the real slayer confessed. The boy was freed. That taught me to be doubly cautious in cases where human liberty or life was involved. Well, I like to hear that here's a guy that will honestly deliberate and won't just go with his gut, won't go because the guy's Italian or because the guy's Catholic or because the guy's Protestant.
Or the jury's bullying him.
The other juries are bullying him. Some of them just want to get home. They're tired of this. They don't really value somebody else's life or freedom that much as they value their own comfort. They want to get home and be comfortable again. Once inside the jury room, someone suggested a straw vote to see how we stood. And if you remember, Aaron, he got together with this other guy to get several people to vote not guilty, no matter what they honestly felt, in order to have more than one vote and in order to cause real deliberation and discussion about this, rather than just everybody vote guilty right off the bat. This was voted down. They did not want to have a straw vote. Instead, we went about the business of choosing a foreman. Wolfersheim, Hendricks, and Walter were nominated. The first two men withdrawing. Walter was elected foreman. I was chosen secretary. The first ballot was taken soon afterward and showed 6 guilty and 6 not guilty. Several jurors grinned at me, and one jokingly remarked, "Prochno, you're a good politician and a vote-getter." Another vote was taken. The result was the same. Foreman Walter became angry and openly accused me of tying up the jury. The usual bickering started, and I later went to the restroom. One of the men followed me in, closed the door, and said, "You're not dumb. You know Capone is a bad man. The papers for years have been full of his activities, and now we have the chance. Let's give him the limit. All you have to do is to give the word, and it will all be over." I replied, "I wouldn't listen to that stuff, nor would I attempt to dictate to anyone how to vote." He really gets into what goes on in the room. He's got into a lot of the interaction, but as he goes on here, he really gets into what goes on inside the jury room.
He really seems to remember a lot. He probably wasn't taking notes on this stuff. at the time.
I don't know. He's got a lot of details.
Like he's
there.
Not in the bathroom when the guy comes in and just writes it down on a piece of toilet paper.
Well, maybe he wrote it down.
I can't believe he was saying that.
Well, maybe he did write it on a piece of toilet paper.
We're all stuck here in these three hotel rooms.
At Wolfersheim's suggestion, the exhibits were handed around the table, leading to hot arguments. One juror made the point that Capone had lost $17,500 gambling in 1 year, and this should offset income, which is true. I more or less agreed with this contention, whereupon one of the jurors who wanted to give Capone the limit left his chair at the opposite end of the table. He carried a handful of checks. "This is enough evidence for me," he shouted. He swished the checks in my face, loosening my spectacles. Silence followed this outbreak. After a long wait, the man apologized. I accepted his apology, saying, "Now we ought to cool off and take a rest." We did this, and then Welding recommended that each of us have the floor and speak uninterrupted. This system was followed, and we all had our say. Some jurors talked about Capone's past, saying he was a leader among bad men. Yet a few had some good words to say about him. Here are some typical remarks.
Capone hired men to bump off people.
There's no proof of that. Capone had a big head.
Conditions made him that way. He's no good. The newspapers have told us he ran disorderly houses and gambling joints.
But he's done good things, such as supporting soup kitchens and helping the poor. All this talk nettled one juror.
Let's forget these things and go by the evidence.
It wasn't that easy. On the whole, I would say that the jury was a timid one. The principal debaters were Larson, Walter, one other man, and myself. Frankly, I liked to debate. As a boy, I had belonged to a debating club. In addition, my services on 9 state juries had acquainted me with law and procedure. I was ready to debate any disputed point. One of the jurors didn't appreciate this. He didn't appreciate my attitude, which I want to say was inspired by a desire for fair play. This juror wanted to give Capone the limit, chided me thus.
Why are you so narrow?
I narrow? Simply because I held off signing a verdict to send a man to prison for long years until I was certain he was guilty as charged in this indictment. A little further on, I shall cite a real example of narrowness. My fighting in the case drew other remarks.
Why are you so interested?
My answer was fair play. One juror wanted to know if I were associated with lawyers or newspapers the way I was debating. Now, even though our arguments were sometimes frenzied, we never really became rowdy. No names were called. A juror would have his say and bow out, maybe angrily, maybe not. One in particular was the type. He'd start an argument, then turn away. He wanted to give but not take. When he was through and didn't get his way, he'd go off to one side and sulk. Once he sat against a wall for half an hour while we finished something he had started. After we had decided some of the differences, we settled down to business. Juror Mather reminded us that there were 2 indictments. He suggested we consider them separately. We took up the first. As secretary, I read it. Juror Welding asked for a straw vote. Juror Hendricks objected. Juror Hendricks objected, but immediately withdrew his objection. The vote was 5 guilty, 6 not guilty, and 1 blank, the blank being mine. I changed it to not guilty, making the vote 7 not guilty and 5 guilty. This was only a test vote, but it showed a deadlock. Then we took up the second indictment, and after a considerable talk, voted on it. The vote was 6 guilty, 4 not, 1 blank, and 1 vote missing. Well, they definitely are deadlocked, that's for sure. Where do you go from here? I guess, did you ever see that movie?
Where did the one missing vote go?
Yeah,
that's a straw vote.
I don't know. 12 Angry Men.
I've never seen it. I've heard of it.
It's great. You can't believe that you can make an interesting movie out of 12 men sitting around in a room talking and this kind of talking, doing exactly these kinds of things. But it really worked. And they started with I think 11 jurors wanting to convict this guy. And by the time they ended up, they voted not guilty. We all realized that we were getting nowhere and that a juror, not the one who had followed me into the restroom, invited me to one side. I told him our discussions must be in the open. He suggested that I ought to stick with his crowd. We belonged to the same fraternal organization and mentioned religion, nationality, and public opinion as reasons for cracking down on Capone.
After all, he's only a Dago.
I told this man those things were out of the question, that we must abide by the evidence as it applied to each count. I said that I was interested only in fair play for the defendant. Frankly, I felt that Capone was guilty of some of the charges, but I wanted to be sure. I wanted to know what I was doing and why I was doing it. As time passed, we became hungry. It was now 8 o'clock Saturday evening. No food was being offered for us. We asked for it, but didn't get it. Some of us resented the idea of being forced into a verdict by starvation. When it became apparent that we weren't progressing much, we instructed the foreman to send word to the judge for advice on the matter of disagreement. Word came back that no disagreement would be allowed. Besides lack of food and our inability to get anywhere, plus rising tempers, and we had another worry. That was whether we might be locked up over Saturday night and Sunday. We wanted to get home, and ever so often we'd receive word that the judge might go home. That would mean a weekend. Naturally, we hurried. I suggested we take up each count. It was generally agreed that the government hadn't put much emphasis on the counts in the first indictment, those covering the first years, and we finally voted not guilty. I was not surprised the Give Him the Limit faction voted for acquittal, for I expected they used their not guilty vote as a lever to pry a few of us holdouts into a guilty vote on the remaining counts. That's exactly what happened. This is fascinating, Aaron, how a jury works and the give and take and how being hungry and being locked up overnight figures into it, and how they're trading off.
Yeah, if the judge goes home, they're all there.
Yeah, right.
They can't come back on Sunday and say, "Hey, we decided."
Right. But how they're willing to trade off? I'll vote not guilty here, but then later on,
they'll expect you to vote.
They'll expect you to vote guilty. On to say, one of the men said that inasmuch they had made an effort by voting not guilty on early counts, we ought to make a concession and vote guilty on the others. I guess I was about the last holdout. Sometime around 10 p.m., about 8 hours after we had received the case, I said I was willing to vote guilty on several counts. But which counts? That meant more argument. Meantime, word came in that the judge was going home. We wanted to go too. Finally, we agreed to the first counts in each year and called it quits. This was 3 felony counts and 2 misdemeanor counts. I can't explain it, but one of these felony counts on which we voted guilty had either been disregarded by some as a not guilty vote. I really believe the intent was to convict Capone on 2, not 3 felony counts and 2 misdemeanors. Foreman Walter drew up the verdict, but he did it incorrectly. We wrote in the 5 guilty counts in the first indictment, number 22S52, on which we had found Capone not guilty. He should have written not guilty on the counts in that indictment and guilty on the 5 counts in the second, number 23232. There were a number of not guilty counts in the second indictment also. The error was understandable since the indictments were all in one. The foreman had to rewrite the verdict. We signed the correct one. I kept the faulty one and still have it. That would be a collector's item. We thought our troubles were over, but just as we were about to leave the room, one of the jurors halted us. "Here, wait a minute," he said. "There were misdemeanor counts in this verdict. He'll only get 10 or 12 years. I want him to have more." Somebody told him, "Forget it," and another said, "Let's get it. Let's get through." But it took us more than 5 minutes to persuade this balky juror to let the verdict stand as it was. We had an uneasy moment in the courtroom when we were polled after the verdict was read. When this juror was asked, "As this and is this your verdict?" I thought he'd say no, but he didn't. We breathed easier. See, Aaron, you vote in private back in the jury room.
Mm-hmm.
And they tally it up, they count the votes, and then so you got a guilty vote, guilty count on counts 1 through 3, and you got a not guilty vote on counts 4 and 5. So then they will poll the jury. The judge will ask the lawyers if they want to poll the jury, and they'll always say, "Let's poll the jury." So each juror, they'll call out their name and say something to the effect of,
"With regards to the particular count?
With regards to the particular count, count 1, is this your verdict? In regards to count 2, is this and was this your verdict?" Or something like that, some saying like that, in order to make them stand up and in public look at the defendant and say yes or no, yes, that's my verdict. which, you know, you have a chance to be, and that's part of the cornerstone of our judicial system, our jury system, is that you have the chance to face your accusers and to face your jurors. It's not ever done in secret. The deliberation's done in secret, but the actual decision has to be brought out in public and right in the face of the person that's being charged with the crime.
Who just happens to be Al Capone in this?
Who just happens to be Al Capone? Really? The court commented that the verdict was inconsistent, very inconsistent. That worried us anew. A 20-minute delay occurred while lawyers looked up the law to see if our verdict was legal. It was. Now, the reading of the verdict and the polling of the jury ended our part in this most unusual, important case. We returned to our homes. I felt at the time, and I still feel, that I did my honest duty. I have no regrets, even if I believe that my part as a juror in the Capone case injured me financially. That part was played in 1931. I was 49 years old. Today at 54, I have finally made a comeback.
When he's saying he made a comeback at 54, some 5 years later, it's because they published this article?
Well, I think what he meant early
he
on...
He cleared his name, and then his business flourished again?
His business. Well, I think his business had already come back again. I think it was right way I read that at the start, it was right after the trial was over that he lost all of his business. It was during the Depression, so, you know, everybody was losing business, and then he lost business, you know, partly because of all this publicity got out of this trial. People didn't want to do business with him. 5 years later, he's made his comeback, and that's when he wrote this article. That's the way I read this. That's why
that he weathered that hardship and came back and
right.
It was, I guess, successful enough for himself, and he felt good about what he did. That he tried to hold up the duty of being a juror.
He did. Everything he said.
Not taking into account anything other, you know, publicity or stories or things that had gone on in the past that weren't really part of the actual trial.
Right, or the man's nationality or his religion. That was the prejudice. He kept that out of it, which, you know, I mean, one can only hope that all jurors do that. Although, you know, there's like in today's world, it's primarily black defendants with primarily white jurors. I've sat and watched those juries sit, and there'll always be a young black man on trial with about 8 out of 12 jurors will be white.
How's that a jury of his peers?
Well, it's
that's no more a jury of his peers than Al Capone's jury, because how many of them were Italian
mobsters.
Catholic mobsters?
Right. So you don't, when you say a jury of the peers, it's kind of a general term. You don't like have a jury of 19-year-old gangbangers. You don't have a jury of 35-year-old Italian Catholic mobsters. So, but that it's always, you know, that's one thing that the prosecutors have been accused of, and many of them have, in regards to black juries. They do not want a black person on the jury if they can help it.
Because that might hang the jury.
That'll hang the jury, or that can't hang the jury.
Well, maybe they feel compelled, and if they're the only black person on the jury.
I don't know. I don't know if I even have an opinion on that. I just know that over the last several years, that has happened, and in actuality, that may happen. It's possible that it happens that you have one person of the same race as the. And it's a minority race that they may vote not guilty just because they're the same race. And they feel like they've already gotten a bad rap just by being black. If you think about it, the what about the O.J. Simpson jury? There was a huge, huge outcry over that verdict. People still claim that verdict was wrong, and that was primarily black women. It's never really been explained, has it? Have you ever read any explanation of how he was found not guilty on
how
that?
He was found, other than the rhyming of the, if the glove doesn't fit, you must
have
quit.
Now that, but I don't know if that's enough or not.
I mean, I don't know if you ever put on a tight-fitting glove, but it doesn't help to put it on if you're stretching your hand out as you're trying to put it on.
Really?
Which is what it appeared to me when I watched the video from that.
That's what it appeared to me. Plus, and then in spite of all the DNA evidence, the blood evidence, and, you know, I guess maybe the Furman, the policeman, did plant the glove. Maybe he took one of the bloody gloves from the scene and then dropped it in the backyard of OJ's home. I don't know. You know, that was the supposition.
But
those are the kinds of things that give you a reason. I know that was her. It was a bloody glove from the scene.
Yeah.
So there's only two explanations: one that OJ did it and dropped it there, or the other explanation is one of the policemen snagged a glove at the crime scene and then took it over and dropped it in OJ's house.
And didn't they kind of, through the cross-examination of Mark Furman, come to the decision that he was essentially a racist?
And exactly. So it's
and because
know,
of that, then he
one.
Must have.
Right. There's no simple answers. There is absolutely no simple answers. Maybe he did. I don't know. And is he
did
the
anybody
one
ever
that
write
found
a book
it?
About that besides Johnny Cochran?
I think Furman may have, and I think one of the prosecutors, one or more of the prosecutors did. There's been several books on that. There's never been any definitive answers. It's always, you know, in the middle. It's in the gray area. What do you think? I personally think Furman was probably a despicable racist. I've worked with a few of them just like him that has those kinds of attitudes. But I don't think that he would have gone so far as to take an item as important as a bloody glove from the scene of a crime and then take it to somebody as high profile as O.J. Simpson and drop it over there. That is beyond the pale.
The DNA tagged the glove to the murder scene, even though the
correct.
Glove wasn't at the murder scene, so it tied it to the body.
Well, the mate to the glove was at the murder scene. There was another glove just like that
just
at,
like
the murder
it,
scene.
At the murder
yeah.
scene.
The mate to that glove was at the murder scene. There is only one explanation for that, that the murderer left the murder scene and went to O.J. Simpson's house and dropped it, or one of the policemen did. There was also other blood evidence inside the house on his socks.
There wasn't
on
DNA
the driveway.
Evidence inside the glove.
That
was
from the victim. There was DNA evidence from the.
I
blood.
Thought that was on the exterior of the glove, and then but
oh,
then
well,
the interior
know.
Of the glove.
I
wouldn't
I
they
know.
Have skin cells or anything? From
probably. I can't remember. That DNA evidence got so convoluted in that thing. I kind of lost track of it without going back and looking at a book and taking notes. That you know, they hired that just goes to show you why poor people get convicted and rich people don't. When you're rich, you hire the dream team, and they can call into question all those kinds of pieces of evidence that a poor person who can't hire their own experts, you can't afford to hire your own experts, so yeah. They can't. You don't have anybody to call in the scientific evidence into question at all.
Public prosecutor's not going to spend a whole lot of time.
Yeah. Well, you mean a public defender.
A public defender.
And they don't have the budget. They just barely have time to do the case and get paid not much over minimum wage, or a little bit over minimum wage. They don't make very much. They don't make lawyers' money, that's for sure. So I'm glad I found this, and I hope that you folks were entertained and educated by this on the jury system. That's how it works. It's just a bunch of regular Joe Sixpacks and Jane Sixpacks now. Back then, there was no women on a jury.
Yeah, but they couldn't make that movie 12 Angry Men now because
there may have to be some women on the jury. Right. But that's how it works. It's give and take, and it's some people that are automatically just believe somebody's guilty because they've been charged with a crime. There's the prosecution needs to be held into account as much as you possibly can, because just the fact that the person has been charged with a crime and is on trial, many, many, many people believe they're guilty and will not even give them a second look.
Without really examining the actual evidence.
They don't care
presented.
About the evidence. They just want to hear a little bit of the story and get this over with and vote him guilty based on their own prejudice, as you saw then. And it's just as true now. People aren't any different now than they were back then. I do believe that for the most part that a jury will come up with the right verdict. And for the most part, the prosecutor brings the correct defendant in the court. But even if one person, one bad conviction goes down, it's not worth it. You need to, as we learned in law school, the reason they have some of these rules that a lot of people don't like the Miranda warning. Miranda was a rapist and a horrible person, but they kind of browbeat a confession out of him and never gave him a chance for a lawyer. Now, you take somebody like that to show the rest of the public that this law protects the most egregious, the most horrendous person in the world. And if our legal system will protect somebody who is just an awful, terrible, evil person, then it'll protect you. And so it's important for people to know that, to have confidence in our jury system and our system. Our judicial system.
Had confidence in that jury system until they switched juries.
Yeah, really.
Until they eliminated juror 930 through 39.
He did not have confidence in the jury system. That's why he was trying to manipulate it. He had confidence in his own system of bribery. All right, I think we're done with this, Aaron. Tell us a little bit about the Big Dumb Fun Show. I just happen to think sometime tonight that we haven't talked about the Big Dumb Fun Show for a while.
The Big Dumb Fun Show is a drive-time-style trending talk, independent, unsigned music, radio, television program that airs live Mondays from 7 to 10 p.m. Central Standard Time, and then in replay all week long, courtesy of the live stream. If you're into podcasting, you can download an entire three-hour episode of great independent, unsigned music and hot trending topics with myself and my co-host, Magesha Jackson.
Who was that group? I came here Monday night and did a little promo for the podcast. Who was that group you had here that night?
Clearly Guilty.
What kind of music did they do?
They do nerdy punk folk music.
I heard them talking. So, I couldn't figure out what they did.
They do music like they do original songs talking about Star Wars or video games or Dungeons and Dragons.
Okay, interesting.
Star Trek, stuff like that.
All right. Well, it's probably never going to go mainstream, but they probably have a niche audience.
Well, their audience is folks like at Planet Comic Con.
Right, and there's a lot of people at those comic book conventions, and they spend money.
They're going to be in Hannibal, Missouri, the weekend of Labor Day weekend performing.
Oh, really?
A steampunk
festival. Yeah, they explained to me what steampunk was, and I can't quite get my mind around it.
Go watch the Sherlock Holmes with Robert Downey Jr.
Okay.
Movie series. That's kind of very steampunk, that 1800s technology.
Yeah.
You know, if it had kind of continued without the invention maybe of electricity or...
Okay, I'll do that. I think I can find that.
That's kind of the theme there. You can find it online. Steampunk is there's actually been a description of someone who came into Chubby's in a review as being, you can find all sorts of people there, nerds, you know, geeks, hipsters, steampunks. You're like, steampunk?
Steampunk.
At the time I read that, I had to look it up. Since then, I've become cooler, and I know what a steampunk is.
All right, good. Well, you know, that's old men got to stay cool. All right, if you have a friend or relative with a problem with addiction to drugs or alcohol, make your first call the first call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org.
And remember to download the Kansas City Mob Tour app so you can take your own self-guided tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City, and then rent the movie that started it all, the documentary Gangland Wire, available on Amazon as a rental or a $7 purchase. Remember to subscribe to Gangland Wire iTunes account and give us a review.
All right. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron.
Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Find them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.